Ramon Broadcast Center, this is Take Two, me Martinez. It might seem like a good thing to be the guest of honor at a party unless it's political and the reward might not be worth the risk. Why Joe Biden and Elizabeth Warren will skip next week's California Democratic Party convention. Plus, a year ago today, the Woolsey fire ignited in Simi Valley and tore its way down to Malibu. How residents are dealing with the aftermath. That's ahead on Take Two. Stay with us. From 89.3 KPCC, this is Take Two. I'm Martinez. Thanks for choosing us this Friday. Coming up, we continue our retrospective of Proposition 187, which sought to bar undocumented immigrants from accessing state services 25 years ago this week. And we'll also hear from writer Richard Montoya, who at the time used comedy and his television platform to criticize the measure.
We were going about the business of bringing levity and humor and humanizing Mexican immigrants. So we had these superheroes called the Orange Man and Busboy Man and Leafblower Man.
Another episode of The Mex Man.
And their arch enemy was Pete Wilson.
That's coming up later in the show, but we're going to kick this Friday off with some state of affairs. That's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, two presidential frontrunners say they'll skip California's Democratic convention next week. We'll get into that story and more with Jack Pitney. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Jack.
Good afternoon.
And also with us for the first time here on State of Affairs, KPCC politics reporter Libby Denkman. Hello, Libby.
All right. Hey, I'm ready. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited, too. All right. So you're going to start us off, Libby. So former Vice President Joe Biden and Senator Elizabeth Warren will both be no-shows at the California Democratic Party convention next week. Surveys show both Warren and Biden respectively leading in the state. So why wouldn't they show up if they're the guests of honor in a way?
Sure, they were definitely desired to show up by the Democratic Party here, and we'll get to that in a little bit. But Biden's campaign said that he has scheduling conflicts, that he needs to be in Washington State at the end of the week next week when the Democratic Party convention starts in Long Beach. He is going to be here on Thursday. He's going to hold a local event at the Los Angeles Trade Technical College. There is some anonymous reporting in Politico, and our friend Carla Marinucci was part of that, indicating, though, that there is more behind that, that he indeed was hesitant to appear before a crowd filled with super activist, more progressive Democrats that don't necessarily represent the breadth and depth of what voters believe in, and that could have caused some embarrassment.
Wow, a politician afraid to stand in front of a crowd? That's kind of their job.
Well, he is, you know, more in a moderate part of the Democratic Party, and these are folks who are Medicare for All, you know, all in on that. These are folks who are, you know, excited about more of this progressive leaning wing of the party, and Joe Biden just doesn't represent that. The other thing is that Jorge Ramos of Univision is hosting the Democratic candidate forums. It's not a debate. It would just be individual forums. They get up and speak one by one with Ramos. And Ramos has been very critical of Biden in the past for being part of the Obama administration, which deported 3 million undocumented people.
And Ramos is not a wallflower, that's for sure.
Not a wallflower. and Biden is clearly not wanting to put himself, according to these sources, of course, in a position where he would be A, embarrassed by booing, or B, embarrassed by Ramos.
Jack Pitney, party chair Rusty Hicks has called their decision a snub. Now, focusing on Joe Biden, Politico reports that the campaign, as Libby describes, is kind of a high risk, low reward the convention would be. Do you think that's what Biden's camp is thinking right now? That's the strategy?
Absolutely. As Libby pointed out, the risk is the convention will be filled with people who aren't sympathetic to Biden. That situation could go south really fast. As far as the reward, what would the reward be? The Democratic primary is on March 3rd. How many people showing up to the polls on March 3rd are going to remember whether or not Biden showed up to this event in November? Very, very few.
Yeah. And the former VP does plan, to appear in California next Thursday, not sticking around for the convention the next day. It's worth mentioning that he's been a no-show, though, no-show at two other high-profile Democratic events this year. Now, for moderates like Biden, who's running in the divided party, how important is it for him to control the message and the arena at this stage of the campaign for him?
The key word is control, and especially if the candidate is Joe Biden. Joe Biden does not do well in unstructured situations. situations. There's a very, very long history with Joe Biden of him making all kinds of mistakes. So if I'm running the Joe Biden campaign, I want him in front of friendly audiences where we know exactly what's going to happen at every moment.
And Libby, in the age of viral media, a video of a candidate getting booed on stage probably not would be a good look. And Senator Warren doesn't face the same challenges as Biden. She's been warmly received, you know, at past Democratic gatherings here. Does the absence of two frontrunners give the other candidates maybe an opportunity to shine, to move up a bit?
Yeah, I want to point out Elizabeth Warren's campaign didn't officially comment on why she's not going to be there, but she has been showing up to other events. She was at a June gathering of the party. She's been at a few this year. So she probably feels like she's got an okay position at this point with the faithful Democratic Party folks who would show up to a convention like this. I mean, it's hard to see what the state of the race is right now, because we do have not a ton of polling on California, unfortunately. Recently, a KQED poll showed that Warren and Sanders are pulling away from Joe Biden a bit. PPIC from September showed it was really still a three-way race. I don't have a crystal ball. I don't know where, you know, the delegates might go if, you know, certain folks fell in the polls or certain folks, you know, embarrassed themselves or what have you. But I know that, as Jack said, it's just not likely that the folks who show up at these forums are going to be representative of the wider voters at the March 3rd primary. And frankly, I think Elizabeth Warren feels like she's put in her time.
And it's one of those things. I always take things back to sports. If you are leading on the scoreboard, you don't play as hard, at least until you have to. If someone's catching up, fine, then put the pedal, the gas on the pedal there a little bit, but don't overextend yourself if you don't have to. Now, moving on, Libby, the California Supreme Court poised to block a California law that would require presidential candidates to disclose their tax returns to appear on the ballot. Now, that's faced some legal challenges from the California GOP and also President Trump's lawyers, largely aimed at the president, who has yet to release his returns. What's been said about this law?
Sure. So Gavin Newsom says this is about transparency, that he wants to give state voters all the information possible. He said that he has a legal and moral duty to do everything in his power to ensure leaders seek the highest offices, who are seeking the highest offices, meet minimal standards and to restore public confidence. But this week there were oral arguments on this, you know, big legal question about whether the state has the authority to add extra hurdles to getting on the presidential ballot. And the California Supreme Court, these justices seem skeptical. I pulled a couple quotes. Justice Chin on the Supreme Court said, "Where does it end? Do we get all high school report cards? Do we get certified birth certificates?
No way. No.
You can see mine. Mine were pretty good. do we get 5 years of medical records?" And Justice Tani Kantil Sakaue was asking, you know, I don't see any necessarily record whether the California legislature, when they passed SB 27, even, you know, considered the California Constitution and whether this was constitutional. So, it doesn't seem like they were entirely on board with what Newsom's administration was saying. The justices do have 90 days to act on this.
Jack, his predecessor, Jerry Brown, did not sign this law. He said it could lead to disturbing consequences. Getting into Governor Newsom's head a little bit, why do you think he signed a bill that was so likely to face legal pushback?
Two big differences between Gavin Newsom and Jerry Brown. First difference, Gavin Newsom wants to play in national politics. He wants to come across as an opponent of Donald Trump and perhaps lay the groundwork in the future for a race at national office. Jerry Brown, by the time of his second governorship, was way past that. He'd been there, done that.
The back nine, right?
Yeah. Not interested in playing that game. But also, Jerry Brown is a lawyer, a very serious lawyer who had served as state attorney general. He had been in charge of appellate cases, and he took the constitutional issues very seriously, and he decided this is just not right.
We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Also, Libby Dankman, KPCC's political reporter. Now, switching gears, I want to take a little bit of time to look back on Prop 187. That was passed by California voters 25 years ago today, actually, November 8th, 1994. Now, that proposition had several effects on politics here. It launched political careers and caused lasting harm to the California GOP. Jack, just to start us off, when you hear about Prop 187, it's often blamed for the decline of the California Republican Party. But that's not really the full story. Republican consultant Mike Madrid put it like this.
it's an easy soundbite. It's an easy way to kind of explain something, but it dramatically oversimplifies the narrative and the extraordinary complexity that California was undergoing in the mid-1990s.
Now, Jack, you were closely tied to Republican politics in the 90s. What do you think most people miss most when it comes to Prop 187 and the California Republican Party?
Well, I think Mike put it exactly right. Yeah, it's an important part of the story, but it's only part of the story. Several other things were going on. Number one, the sheer growth of the Hispanic population. Hispanics had voted Democratic for a long time, but partly as a result of changes in immigration laws by the 1990s and 2000s, there were a lot more Hispanics voting Democratic. Second, end of the Cold War. The defense jobs disappeared, and the people who were in those defense jobs tended to support Republicans because of national security issues. If you remember the old Michael Douglas movie, Falling Down, that guy was probably a Republican, and those jobs are gone. And also, education. There's an increasing relationship between level of education, professional work, and the Democratic Party. Take Silicon Valley. Tremendous growth in places like Silicon Valley, and the people holding those jobs are Democrats. I just wrote a book on the 88 election. George Bush did really well, didn't carry Santa Clara County, Silicon Valley, but did reasonably well. And by 2016, it was a total blowout.
And to your point, Jack, about those defense jobs leaving, Mike Madrid makes the point that those likely Republican workers left. They just left California. It's like we were exporting Republicans to the Midwest.
Yeah. In the movie, Michael Douglas met a different fate, but in general, you know, the people moved away.
Spoiler. Don't spoil them. Yeah. It's been out, what, 2 decades? I get emails all the time, even for movies that are 30 years old. Now, Libby, remind us about the context of Prop 187. Which was championed by then-Governor Pete Wilson. He told Air Talk recently that he really pushed it to send a message to Washington. What does he say his goal was, and what was his real effect?
Sure. It was interesting to listen to that interview between Larry Mantle and Governor Wilson. Wilson reminded folks that, you know, he wanted to be on board with Prop 187. He actually endorsed it in September before the election, but his campaign was actually saying, no, don't do it. I mean, they were advising against it. That's what he says happened. And he says it's because he believed in the rule of law. He believed that there needed to be a message about Washington helping states pay for what he saw as a burden of taxpayer dollars going to education for young people who were undocumented, or for health care services, for incarcerating people who were in the country without authorization. You know, of course, we think about it now and we see that, you know, it definitely drove this wedge between Latinos and the Republican Party. I don't think that there's any question. And Mike Madrid, you know, agrees with that. Yeah. He also went on to argue that the Latino population, however, the voting block that it represents now is simply not large enough to explain this like gigantic decline in the Republican Party. So certainly economic factors, other things are also part of that.
And Libby, you've been looking at the political careers that were effectively launched by this push. It gave rise to several Latino lawmakers. How did 187 end up catalyzing a generation, so to speak?
It really did. I spoke with Wendy Carrillo, who's the 51st District Assemblywoman, who represents a lot of the east side of LA, Northeast and Boyle Heights. And she was talking about being in high school, freshman at the time that 187 was going on, and there were these massive school walkouts, and she was able to go on her PA system and announce, hey, and you know, we're gonna have french fries for lunch today, and we're also walking out. You know, it's just this total rallying cry for a group of folks who prior to that had not been as engaged in the political process. There was a bump in naturalizations right after 187 passed. There was you know, over the course of the 90s, this huge shift in the number of lawmakers, people running for office. I talked to Kevin De Leon, who was an organizer at the time of teachers and the protests in Los Angeles. And he said he never would have run for political office. Fabian Nunez saying the same thing, that they ran for political office because of these protests. So no doubt this was a monumental jolt to the Latino community at a time when people really decided to step up and become part of the political process.
All right, one big spoiler here. Vader is Luke's father. There, just in case no one's seen
How
it. I just ruined
you,
that
a
movie. Libby Denkman is KPCC's political reporter. Jack Pitney, Roy P. Crocker, professor of politics at Claremont McKenna College. Jack, Libby, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, as we just heard, 25 years ago today, California voters passed Prop 187 that sought to bar undocumented immigrants from accessing state services like public schools and health care. Now, the conversations around 187 on both sides were often passionate and heated, but every once in a while, they were comedic. Coming up, how one performer used laughter as the best medicine to cure angst over 187. We'll hear his story when Take Two continues in about 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. In the midst of California's deepening housing crisis, the state has handed Southern California a big task. Plan for at least 1.3 million new homes by 2029. But where to put all those new apartments and houses? Well, yesterday, after a contentious meeting, local representatives voted against an initial plan to emphasize growth in the Inland Empire, and they voted instead to plan for most new growth in L.A. and Orange County. Now, to understand how they got there, we have KPCC's David Wagner in the studio. David, welcome back.
Great to be here, eh?
All right. First off, what is this housing goal we're talking about? Where does it come from?
So under state law, every 8 years, regions in California have to plan to zone for new housing. Here, that decision goes through the Southern California Association of Governments, or SCAG, which is comprised of local representatives across six counties. Originally, SCAG told the state it only wanted to plan for 430,000 new homes by 2029, but the state's housing department said that that number was too low, so they tripled it, telling Southern California, no, you need to plan for 1.3 million homes.
Yeah, that is one big difference, David.
It's definitely a big difference. I mean, that level of home building would be a pretty big sea change for Southern California. But, you know, it comes at a time when we all know that high housing costs are causing real pain. You know, millions of people are stretching their budgets to pay rent, home ownership is increasingly out of reach, and middle-class families, we're seeing them flee California for cheaper states like Texas and Arizona. We just haven't been building enough housing to keep up with population growth.
Now, you went to this regional planning meeting yesterday. What were they voting on?
So SCAG's job now is to decide how to divvy up these 1.3 million homes that the state wants us to build across Southern California cities. SCAG had two options on the table yesterday. The first plan would have really focused new home building in the Inland Empire while giving many wealthy coastal communities fairly low housing numbers to meet. So to break that down, it would have asked cities like Coachella, Hemet, and Paris to plan for more than 10,000 homes each, while giving places like Laguna Beach a goal of just 55 new homes. And LA City Councilman David Rue really tore into that plan. He said it would force people to live further east, far from their jobs, adding cars to congested freeways and increasing greenhouse gas emissions.
This proposal tells millions of working people who work in job-rich communities that they should not have the opportunity to live where they work, and instead must commute from greater and greater distances. This is bad for climate policy. This is bad social policy. And it's nothing short of economic redlining.
In other words, what he means is lower income people would have had even fewer housing options in LA and Orange counties.
Yeah, we're hearing about people quitting their jobs because the commute is just too long. Now, that plan actually got voted down yesterday. What took its place?
That's right. So SCAG instead decided on a different plan, which emphasizes putting homes closer to major job centers and transit lines, meaning in effect more homes in LA and Orange counties.
All right, but how did representatives from the West Side and Orange County respond?
Well, most of the people who voted against this new plan were from Orange County. The new plan increases their overall housing goal by about 75,000 homes. And a lot of people in Orange County don't want more growth. So, you know, we saw some wealthy areas that had low housing goals under the original plan now see their numbers spike. For instance, Yorba Linda's number went from just about 200 new homes to more than 2,300.
Wow.
Yorba Linda City Councilwoman Peggy Huang was there. She voted against the plan, this new plan. And she said what we should do is tell employers to move out to the Inland Empire.
Us as a jurisdiction in Orange County and Los Angeles, where it's job rich, we should be encouraging companies to go out there. Don't look at us. Go over there. We'll even hook you up with the elected officials and help you get there.
So I think that tells you a lot about the politics of housing in parts of Southern California. You know, given the choice between fewer jobs and more housing, some local leaders would choose fewer jobs.
All right. So what happens now, David? Are these new housing goals set in stone?
They're not set in stone yet. The state has some time to review the plan. Then cities will get a chance to appeal their housing goals. The final numbers won't come out until next year. And keep in mind, you know, just because cities have to plan for this new housing, it doesn't mean any of it will actually get built. In the past, most cities that fail to meet their goals haven't really faced any repercussions.
That's KPCC's David Wagner breaking down a crucial vote on the future of housing growth in Southern California. David, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
All right, moving on. All this week, we've been looking back on a pivotal time in California's history. In 1994, Proposition 187 was passed by voters. Now, it sought to prohibit undocumented immigrants from using public services provided by the state. But the bill prompted a large public outcry by migrant communities who felt targeted by the measure. Some activists even took their voices to the airwaves, like comedian and writer Richard Montoya and his troupe, Culture Clash. In a recent conversation, he shared what was going on through his mind when he took his edgy combination of activism and humor to a conservative-leaning TV station.
At that time, Culture Clash was fairly established in the American theater, played larger venues in LA and had toured, and we were this weird luck of landing a television show on the local Fox-owned station, which had 9 stations throughout the country. So we happened to be on the air in and around this time. And here comes Pete Wilson and 187, and we're kind of caught in that funny place of kind of dominating the 7 o'clock hour on Saturday on the local Fox station, which meant, in a way, a certain amount of power and a much wider breadth of our reach in terms of an audience. Very upset with the anti-immigration fervor. We had already done work in San Diego on the border. There was a right-wing radio host down there in San Diego, Roger Hedgecock. We were very aware of Light Up the Border and militias and spending time interviewing people, both border crossers and border patrol. So we were up on our game. We just happened to be on one of the most conservative television stations. Fox let us go for 30 shows, but I remember going fast and furious, almost using every show to make an anti-Pete Wilson statement. And I do recall Rupert Murdoch standing in our control booth, and he didn't appear to be too happy or angry, just a slight man that just had a faint smile. I remember the night that Rupert Murdoch came in, we were canceled shortly after. Dolores Huerta was our special guest, and each week we'd have a guest do a word of the day. And I believe on that show, we had a very satirical sketch called American Border Gladiators.
Let's begin the final stages of American Border Gladiators! Come on!
Immigrants from Central America and Mexico would compete to cross the border with athletic-looking Americans that were trying to keep the people from crossing the border. And it was done in one of those kind of 80s, early 90s, those kind of fake athletic shows where people were competing. And the prize here was to get citizenship, to get a green card.
Let's talk to today's remaining contestants. Finishing his final leg from El Salvador, please meet Rodolfo. Rodolfo,
in and around that same time, we were going about the business of bringing levity and humor and humanizing Mexican immigrants. So we had these superheroes called the Orange Man and Busboy Man and Leaf Blower Man.
Another episode of The Mex Man. Mighty mutated Mexicans transformed by toxic waste dumped by American factories in a small Mexican village.
And their arch enemy was Pete Wilson. And the INS border goons would hold up a photo of Pete Wilson, the large 8x10, and these X-ray laser beams would come out of Pete Wilson's eyes and zap whoever's in front of it back to Mexico. each and every week we were really kind of pushing those boundaries and pushing that envelope. And I didn't realize till, you know, I started getting on airplanes and traveling and stuff that we were also angering a lot of people. There were not that many people of color on television. The question that most haunts me is, did our art help or did it hurt? You know, did we push moderate Anglos away from us? 187 wins overwhelmingly, and I'm not sure. I'd like to think that we helped. In the end, it's still an open question. I think that in our upward mobility as, you know, Latinos, even Latinx and Hispanics and that large middle class that kind of grew in Los Angeles, and you see it at the Laker games and at the Dodger games, we're doing quite well. And then something like the Trump administration comes around and it's like, holy cow, what's Make America Great Again about? What are these attitudes? What laws will Steve Miller come up with next? And you begin to feel, what is this very heightened, more focused attitude towards brown children, specifically brown children being ripped away from parents? And you kind of say, what the hell? I thought we were doing much better than this. And then it kind of snaps. I just think the role of the artist cannot be overlooked, the role of poets, the role of songmakers, and sometimes we help provide definition to a movement. On the TV show, Lalo Alcaraz was one of our writers, so was Josefina Lopez was one of our writers, Steve Higgins, who's the on-air sidekick for Jimmy Fallon, a lot of folks, veteran folks from the Groundlings, this was our writing team. And we went about in a kind of a media campaign, a media war against what we thought was rather unjust. And that was a very negative campaign against immigrants in a nation of immigrants. So these things are vitally important, and the artist has a role to play in it all.
That was actor and screenwriter Richard Montoya reflecting on his artistic response to Prop 187 and the lasting influence it had on his work in the years that followed. And if you want to see clips from Culture Clash, you can head over to our website. That's take2.org. About a year ago today, the Woolsey Fire ignited in Simi Valley and tore its way down to Malibu. I was just in the area reporting on how the National Park Service is doing with plant restoration efforts. We're going to hear all about that on Monday. But up next, we're going to hear from the people who lived through the Woolsey Fire, survived it, and how they've tried to recover from that trauma in the years since. That's next when Take Two continues. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. The most destructive wildfire in L.A. County history ignited 1 year ago today. Fueled by 60-mile-per-hour Santa Ana winds, the Woolsey Fire sent flames and embers barreling down canyons, destroying homes, farms, and neighborhoods in its path. The city of Malibu was hit very hard. All residents were ordered to evacuate. By the time the fire was out, it had burned 95,000 acres, took out 1,500 structures, and killed three people. Take Two contributor Adriana Cargill spoke to Malibu residents who lived through that devastating fire and brings us this story.
Ari Sofer didn't find out about the Woolsey Fire until early Friday morning on November 9th, 2018, the day after it started. At first, he wasn't going to evacuate, but then
it might have been around noonish that sort of people started deciding that it was time to move because this enormous fire basically was really looking just horribly scary, and it was kind of coming toward us at that point.
When the fire reached his home in the canyon above Point Doom in Malibu, flames quickly surrounded it on all sides.
Enormous flames. I mean, there was a fire tornado behind my back fence. The walls of the tornado, 50 feet tall, of flames spinning kind of, and just making this horrible noise, you know, like, you know, it looked like a poltergeist.
So he decided to leave. And to avoid traffic going south on PCH, he went north towards Oxnard. But he soon hit a blockade. There was so much smoke, it looked like night, even though it was only afternoon.
It was like the apocalypse. Like, no sun was able to come through. It was like almost black, filled with smoke glowing orange because of the flames everywhere.
So he chose to take the back roads. He was alone with his dog, speeding across the asphalt on the wrong side of the road, praying no one was coming the other way. Flames rushed up from the canyons, coming over his car. This is actual sound from a video he took on that drive. Like anyone caught in that kind of situation, Sofer was worried that he might not make it out.
You know, like I was kind of praying that I would when that fire came up over the car, and right before then too, it was looking pretty bad, but when that fire came up over the car, I was pretty, I wouldn't want to be there again.
Sofer did make it out alive that Friday afternoon, car and dog intact. But others stayed behind, people like Kevin Michaels, a lifelong Point Doom resident. It was around the same time that Sofer was desperately navigating the back roads of Malibu to escape the flames that Michaels was in the thick of it, trying to help his neighbors defend their home.
It was futile. We were throwing buckets of water at flames, and you would watch it turn to steam before it ever got to the fire itself. You know, it was just like, it was sad. So I told them, I'm like, hey, I got to go. And they looked at me kind of like, and I'm like, I don't know if you guys should stay. Like, it's looking pretty bad, but I'm going back to my house.
And just as he did, it started to rain embers.
So what I would do is I would watch the embers land. And because there was too many, you're talking thousands of embers landing in a second, dude. Like, at one point I looked up and it just looked like solid embers going at like 40 miles an hour. They were about 40 feet off the ground and they were just blowing in a straight line across the point from the mountainside. It was crazy. And it did that for hours and hours.
His strategy was simple. Keep his pine trees and his neighbor's woodpile from going up in flames. It wasn't easy. There was no electricity. That had been cut off. And there was no water pressure. So he resorted to water from his jacuzzi, shovels, fire extinguishers, anything he could find to put the embers out. He worked for hours, until about 1:30 in the morning, and by then he was so exhausted, he decided to try and take a power nap.
I went to sleep at 2 a.m., and at like right before my 15-minute snooze alarm went off, I just got woken up by like a huge glow come through my back slider door. I run outside, and that pile of wood's on fire.
The wood pile was 6 feet tall and 5 feet deep, and despite his efforts to keep it from catching fire, thousands of logs were now in flames.
I was like, oh my God, dude, this is like, maybe this is the end. I was like, all right, dude, I fought my house for 8 hours, and dude, it finally, like, that was my thing. If that wood lights on fire, I don't see how I'm going to stop. I can't, like, there's nothing that's going to put it out, you know?
So he left.
I ran back to my car. My car doesn't start. So I'm like, I'm like, oh my God, I guess I'm staying and fighting this fire. You know, there's nowhere to go now.
Meanwhile, the log fire was spiraling out of control.
And I was like trying to beat the shovel into the dirt. It was basically hopeless. I was just at that point going, gosh, dude, like, you know, and all of a sudden it was like the weirdest thing ever. These six guys in all black with black things wrapped around their face to keep the smoke out came jumping over the fence. Landed there and came running up, and they had pickaxes, and they started picking up the dirt and they started throwing dirt on this fire. And so we stayed there from 2 a.m. till 5:30 a.m. containing that fire in that backyard.
Together, they shoveled dirt onto the fire until it went out.
And then as fast as they showed up, like the second it was all good, I was kind of exhausted to death due to and not paying attention, and I turned around and they were gone. They didn't say anything. There was no like high fives. It was just like they were like on to the next battle, I guess.
Michaels and his home made it through the fire thanks to these mysterious men. But he was lucky. As the sun came up on Saturday morning, Point Doom residents who hadn't stayed were desperate to know whether their homes had survived. Brianna Strange came by boat. It was her dad's suggestion. He lived on Point Doom. But Strange, she wasn't too thrilled by the idea.
I said, that sounds like my worst nightmare. I am scared of fires. I don't really want to be trapped in Malibu during a fire, but also I really want to see if our house is still standing.
So they boated in. When they got there, she gasped.
At that point, you couldn't see the point. It was just shrouded in smoke. And I remember being really shocked when I realized that we were passing by Big Doom on the boat because I didn't even recognize where we were along the coast because it was so smoky.
Their dinghy was broken, so they ended up swimming into Zuma Beach, fully clothed.
And I remember being like, this is how you die. You like jump off a boat in the middle of a fire in your clothes and you swim to shore. You have no idea. I'm like, this is insane. I don't want to do this. But at that point, I just did it.
She made it to her dad's house, which had survived the fire. But then she decided to stay, volunteering at a makeshift service center set up by the community to help residents in need. She was really worried by what she heard people saying.
People were coming up and saying like, oh my God, my house just burned down. I don't have insurance or something like that. And as an attorney, I was like, uh-oh, this is not good.
This experience changed her life. And Strange is now starting her own firm specializing in insurance. Kevin Michaels, who owns the Killer Shrimp Restaurant in Marina Del Rey, spent much of the rest of that week bringing supplies and meals to the residents in the community. And Ari Sofer? A year after the fire, I visited him at his home in the canyon, which, by the way, survived. I wanted to see how his neighborhood is recovering. We sat in his front yard, and he pointed out empty lot after empty lot where houses once stood.
And right past the trees on the other side of the canyon, there are three properties that you can see that are basically burned or cleared. There's people over there with chainsaws clearing some trees, and four burned houses directly in my line of sight.
Looking around, I noticed a lot of baby plants.
They're coming back. Everything is growing back. It's actually a natural process anyway. Everything burns off and then it regrows, and plants were springing up within a week. It was really incredible because the ground was just black and then a sprout of green would shoot up in the middle of that. So the regrowth and the rebirth happened really fast.
There's still a lot of devastation and rebuilding to do in Malibu, but there are also signs of regrowth and healing, if you know where to look for them. For Take Two, I'm Adriana Cargill.
All right, with Veterans Day on Monday, some of you will have some extra weekend fun time to fill. What to do? Well, the fine folks of KPCC and LAist have teamed up to compile the best list of the coolest stuff to do. Plus, we'll also have details on cuisine that could become your new foodie obsession. That's all coming up when Take Two continues in 60 seconds. Stay with us. Back now with more Take Two on 89.3 KPCC. I'm A. Martinez. It's time for another edition of Food Fridays, when we invite some of our colleagues and contributors from our sister site, LAist, to talk about one of our favorite subjects. And this week, we have Fiona Chandra helping us explore one culture's food that has been a bit under the radar in Los Angeles, and that's Indonesian cuisine. Fiona, thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
All right. Now, in your piece, you say the variety of Indonesian food runs parallel to the country's geography. Tell us more about that.
So Indonesia has a large Chinese population as well as many different tribes that live on the different islands. And because there is an island nation, most of them are relatively isolated from each other. So when you go to different regions, different islands in Indonesia, the food can be wildly different. Like in Java, they tend to like sweeter things. Well, you go to Sumatra and they have very spicy food.
Wow. So those are big differences then. You got to know where you're going a little bit to kind of enjoy the food.
Yes, a little. Although now, of course, the popular dishes have made their way around the country.
Now, the country itself, Indonesia, is largely practices Islam, right?
Yes.
How much does that factor into the cuisine?
It does factor a lot in the sense that there's not a lot of pork dishes mm-hmm. that's available. But you go to, for example, Bali is still primarily Hindu. So if you go to Bali, the most popular dish is babi guling, which is the suckling pig. But if you go to Java, you won't find a lot of pork dishes.
Okay. So now, aside from that country's size, the mix of cultures make Indonesian cooking really unique. So what types of cuisine play off of each other in Indonesian food?
So primarily, I think Chinese has a big influence on the Indonesian cuisine. For example, there's a lot of noodle dishes that come from the Chinese culture. For example, in Medan and Sumatra, there's a lot of Hokkienese, particular Chinese, I guess, tribe. Mm-hmm. A lot of kue tiao, which is the flat egg noodles. We make them slightly differently.
What's your favorite region when it comes to cuisine? I know you probably like them all, but I'm asking you to pick one. What would you say is one region of Indonesia that hits me really well?
Oh, that's tough. I grew up in Java, so I like a lot of the different Java dishes. Mm-hmm. But my father comes from Medan, and our family is a huge Medan Hokkienese food lovers.
So you won't pick one?
I'll pick two.
You pick two? Okay, that's fine. You can like any of them. I'm just trying to put you in a corner there. We're talking to Fiona Chandra about Indonesian cuisine, especially here in Los Angeles. Now, 1/3 of all Indonesian Americans in the country live in LA County, a fair amount of restaurants to serve them. So let's go on a bit of a tour. Fiona, tell us about some of the places that you visited in LA.
One of my favorite is Borneo Kalimantan cuisine, which is in Alhambra. So this is more of a lot of that Chinese Indonesian food that I mentioned, a lot of like Hokkienese and Hakka noodle dishes. And then I also think Kasih in downtown LA is kind of great in terms of bringing Indonesian food to sort of a finer dining and more mainstream level, because a lot of the previous ones are sort of mom and pop shops that may go under the radar. And then Simpang Asia, or Simpang Asia, in Palms is very popular. They have a pretty large menu, so you can explore the different regions, like the different variations of Indonesian cuisine, and still is like very popular with Indonesian students on the west side.
Let me ask you about taking Indonesian cuisine to a kind of a finer dining level, because sometimes when that happens, there seems to be a resentment in that, look, cuisine should be accessible to everyone. Why does it have to take this kind of higher level, so to speak? Is that at all something that is talked about in Indonesian cuisine circles?
In Indonesian cuisine, I feel like it's talked about a little less. And I do wonder, maybe it's partly because it is so under the radar and people are not familiar or used to it, versus tacos or Vietnamese food. Everyone is so used to having it in LA for such a cheap price, but most of them are not familiar. Now it's something new and so exciting for them. So I don't hear as much complaints about
the So bring the attention
level.
On however you can
exactly.
get, right? Yeah. Now, is there anything that someone who has not tried Indonesian cuisine should know before they try it? You mentioned how if they're going, they should not expect pork on the menu. So anything else they need to be ready for?
Yes, they can be pretty spicy. I guess it's might be similar to Thai cuisine in the terms of a lot of coconut milk is used in their curry, but it's a very different flavor profile, like rendang from Sumatra, probably one of the more popular dishes nationwide, and it can be pretty spicy.
So if someone wants to make the comparison, Thai cuisine maybe is the closest to it.
Unless they're familiar with Malaysian food, yes.
Okay. All right. That's LA's contributor Fiona Chandra guiding us through LA's Indonesian food scene. And if you want to check out the restaurants we've talked about or see all the mouth-watering pictures, just visit our partner site, laist.com. That's laist.com. Fiona, thanks for coming in.
Thank you.
All right, finally, there is a long weekend ahead for many of us, and we can help you plan it out.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran. A. Martinez Veterans Day weekend is here.
Yep.
So I've got events for vets, but also for families, hipsters, and more.
Like what?
Okay, so for veterans, there are great events all around the region to celebrate your service. But here's a special one on Veterans Day at LA Memorial Coliseum itself, which, of course, is dedicated to vets. Yeah. Starting at 9, it'll be a whole day filled with speeches, performances, and more. So, for example, the USO show troop takes the stage. Also, the Navy Junior ROTC drill team will be there, too. And at 11 o'clock, there will be a torch lighting ceremony. And for vets themselves, there will be things like booths to feature community resources as well. So when you go, just RSVP and get tickets. But bonus, it's all free.
All right, but that's Monday, Leah. What about something before Monday?
Well, head to Griffith Park on Sunday. There's a great event for families. It's called Harvest Fest, and it's at the heart of the park near the merry-go-round, all to celebrate fall, even though temperature-wise, it does not feel like fall. During the day, there is going to be performances by a polka band, for example. Love it. Bounce house, pumpkin painting, plus arts and crafts vendors and food trucks. Then once the sun goes down, there is going to be a free screening of that Pixar film, Coco, so bring some tissues.
Love that movie.
And when you go, it's free.
All right, now there's something else for people who love cartoons like Coco, right?
Yeah, this one's also on Sunday, but it's at the Pasadena Convention Center. It's ToonCon.
ToonCon.
Yeah, you'll get to meet animators, voice artists, and more. So people like Floyd Norman, who's this guy who's worked on films like 101 Dalmatians and The Jungle Book, the creator of The Fairly Odd Parents, Butch Hartman, will be there. Also, this is a big one for me, the voice of Winnie the Pooh, Tigger, and Darkwing Duck, Jim Cummings, is going to be there.
Nice.
I know his voice very well. Plus, check out the vendors selling illustrations, toys, and more. Tickets start at $15 to get in, but kids 12 and younger get in free with an adult.
Now, Leo, what about for something like me, an adventurous type?
How about adventurous food type? Adventurous for some. Lutefisk, which is basically pickled whitefish, essentially. Well, it's huge among Nordic cultures. I just saw your face. You do not like this idea. But there's a big dinner to celebrate it in Van Nuys today and tomorrow. It's the annual Lutefisk dinner, which is a tradition that spans more than 35 years. It happens at the Nerona Lodge, and it's to celebrate fall and winter coming. And if not everyone in your party wants to get loco with Lutefisk, then there are some homemade meatballs available too. When you go, it's $22 for adults and $11 for kids. Now, that is not all. The KPCC LAS gang have a lot more to share of what to do this weekend. You can check it out on LAIST.com. That is LAIST.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat.
That's our very own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks.
See you later, eh?
I miss my colleagues when I don't see them, and I don't think I've seen John Horn in quite a long time. He hosts The Frame, that's KPCC's arts and entertainment show. I saw you earlier today, but I'm seeing before today. I haven't seen you in a long time, John.
I've been working hard.
I know you have. I know you have. I need to get my John Horn fill.
Well, here I am.
All right, good, good. So what's on the show? Show's on every single day, 3:30, weekends at Saturday at 2.
Yeah, and we have slightly darker stuff than I think we've been talking about for the last couple of minutes. We have a really good interview with Mark Ruffalo, who you know well from...
Hulk.
Yeah, Hulk. Yeah. So he's playing a very different kind of superhero. He's playing a lawyer called named Rob Bellotti. He's in a movie coming up in a couple of weeks called Dark Waters. It's about a lawyer who took on DuPont over Teflon. It's good for your pants. It's bad for your body. Yeah. It's a really good interview with Mark Ruffalo about a different kind of superhero. We also have an interview with Nell Scovell. She's a TV writer who worked with David Letterman, wrote about his workplace tactics and his discrimination against women. She finally had a sit down with David Letterman about her complaints about his behavior. She comes in to talk about working with David Letterman and her face-to-face with Dave.
That's The Frame with John Horn, Monday through Fridays at 3:30 and then Saturdays at 2. John, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
All right, that's it for Take Two this week. Our show was produced and directed this week by Lori Skywalker Galleretta and Leo Duran Duran. Someone else wrote that one. Emily Henderson, Itzi Quintanilla, Carolyn Champlin, and Gabriel Dunatov helped us out this week. Our editor is Sue Carpenter. Hazmik Pogosian and Richard Garcia engineered the show. Our senior producers this week are Megan Larson and Austin Cross. And if you missed any part of the show, just look for us wherever you get your podcast. There we will be waiting to be heard by you. You can also find us on social media. We're at Take Two. That's at Take Two. And I'm at A Martinez LA. Thanks for listening. Thanks for trusting us with your time. Take Two. We'll be back Monday at 2. Talk to you then.